Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Work to ramp up recreational marijuana sales in the first state continues, with some new laws helping make medical marijuana dispensaries part of that industry.
This is going to go a long way to making sure that the program gets up and running soon, because Delawareans have waited long enough.
We hear from a medical dispensary operator about their potential role in selling legal cannabis. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about the threat Delaware could face from the box tree moth. Arts Playlist takes us to the Biggs Museum to hear about their latest exhibition. And Enlighten Me introduces us to a couple trying to bring an ossuary to the first state. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Governor John Carney signed several marijuana bills into law last week, paving the way for existing medical marijuana businesses in Delaware to start recreational sales on an expedited basis. HB 408, amended to support social equity in the cannabis industry, would allow current medical marijuana providers to convert to dual-use licensees that could serve both registered patients and adults over 21. This week, Delaware Public Media's Sarah Petrowich spoke with Adam Gores, Senior Vice President of Corporate Affairs for the Cannabis Company, which currently operates three medical dispensaries in the first state, about the prospect of medical marijuana providers soon being able to sell recreationally to customers.
So tell me a little bit about how this conversion process is going to work in enabling compassion centers to serve registered medical cardholders as well as those recreational users.
Yeah, well, I'll take a step back and just point out that, you know, this is a, you know, really pragmatic piece of legislation that's not only going to allow the medical operators to enter the market, and remind you that the medical operators have been, you know, compliantly serving, you know, the approximately 10,000 Delawareans that are using cannabis to treat a medical or a health and wellness condition under the supervision of a physician. And these are high quality products, and we have a track record. And so we're, you know, thrilled that, you know, policymakers are looking to us to help kickstart this market. And that's because, you know, every state that has come before us has looked to medical operators to, you know, be one piece of the foundation of how successful sales get off the ground. And it's because we do it every day. And also recognizing from states across the country, if you don't include medical operators in this, the medical program essentially goes away just from the economics of a much larger market size for adult use and medical patients that may choose to self-treat at what may be a more convenient and potentially a lower cost adult use operator. And that's surely because of economics of being able to serve a larger market. And so just like almost every other state in the country, we will now be able to continue to serve our medical patients, but we'll also be able to serve those new adult use customers. And I'll remind you that many of those adult use customers are seeking that cannabis to treat a medical or health and wellness condition, but have not gone to a physician. So you can think of that as over the counter. And I'll point out that this bill is going to allow sales to come quicker, which is, you know, cannabis doesn't grow overnight, and new operators are going to need time to develop their facilities. And this is a bridge to getting to a more robust adult use marketplace. And I'll point out that this is a public health and safety consideration, to be able to get adults into the regulated marketplace. It's also an economic development consideration of being able to get businesses jump-started. And finally, it's an issue ultimately for the Treasury in Delaware that's going to bring in funds derived from cannabis sales to fund important programs.
There's tons of stuff you hit there that I definitely want to dive into a little bit deeper. I think kind of coming back to that first part of the question about, you know, the market kind of look like when you create a dual use market now. Is there any special training required for employees that they have to go through to do this type of conversion program? Yeah. Or any other, like, niche considerations that you have to take into account for?
Well, absolutely is the answer to that. Our employees are already going through the training to prepare for adult use because it takes time. It means that we need to ramp up to higher levels of production. So we are bringing in new team members. And then ultimately for our dispensing staff, that'll soon be going through, in-depth training on, how to better serve somebody that's coming in to purchase cannabis, perhaps for something different than a medical reason. Our teams are already really experienced, so this isn't a hard transition.
So talking a little bit about how the proceeds from this market, a big part of this legislation was ensuring that those proceeds from the conversion program go towards the social equity license holders,
yes.
Right? Those are those looking to enter the business that have been disproportionately affected by marijuana prohibition. So I know that program is on the state side, but how do you see partnerships going forward with helping social equity license holders get on their feet? And I know one of the things you mentioned was, the crops can't grow overnight, right? And if you want to get the market up and running, it's a, enabling existing infrastructure to be utilized is helpful. So talk a little bit more about that.
We have a track record of transitioning from medical to adult use in a number of places, whether it's Illinois or right next door in New Jersey, Massachusetts, and now New York. We're ready for it in that sense. We've done this many times before. We sell adult use cannabis in 9 states throughout the country. Every state is different, and every state we're doing it yet better again. We've partnered with social equity businesses, I'd venture to say, in almost all of those other states, just like we will in Delaware. We're broadly supportive of these social equity programs, both through the funding that will go to give them a jump start. But really, I'll point out that we've seen in states the most beneficial relationship is ultimately a commercial one, where we're able to form joint ventures or to co-produce brands that use our expertise and allow a new entrepreneur to get up and running quicker. And that's something we've done in New Jersey and something that we already have plans to do in Delaware.
And I think transitioning a little bit, we've talked about a lot of the benefits of this. There are some advocates, who were against enabling conversion licenses in the legislative process. They noted things like concerns of unfair competition by giving the medical industry a head start, as well as voicing complaints that the existing medical industry hasn't been able to keep up with the current registered demand. So this could potentially increase strain on the market. I mean, do you have any thoughts on these concerns or any responses, I guess, to those who see it as a concern, giving the medical industry a head start into the recreational industry?
Well, I'd point out that every state that's done it before has done it for the fact that the medical program wouldn't exist once adult use sales got up and running. So, really this was a bill to protect the medical businesses. We're serving our patients, really well in the state. It's a small market. I'll also remind you that we're still under federal illegality, which makes it really difficult for us to operate. And we're hopeful due to President Biden's leadership, Delaware's own, that'll soon be changing. But it's a tough market. We've shown in state after state that we can continue to serve medical patients really well. And ultimately, this bill is, going to benefit public health safety. It's going to benefit patients in the long run that are going to get better and cheaper access to supply. It's going to help jumpstart new businesses. It's going to provide tax revenue into the state. And all those things come from looking to medical operators to play a role in the rollout of adult use sales. What we've seen in state after state is it may be the medical operators that are the ones that are some of the first to get up and running. The contrary point or the alternative is ultimately for the illicit market to be the one that continues. And so I think from good public policy, being able to get regulated sales off the ground as soon as possible is the benefit of almost all.
Definitely. And I know you talked about this being a protection for the medical industry. And I know you've talked about New Jersey, but one other follow-up on that, I did want to note that I remember in public hearings that there were advocates who actually said that New Jersey was an example of where this program sort of failed in a sense, or at least it was floundering. And they argued that there wasn't enough done by the state to maintain a robust medical program. Is that something that you have seen, or do you feel like Delaware could suffer a similar fate, or do you not even agree with those claims, honestly, and feel that
I don't agree with it at all. I think it's lack of right information, and there's a reason why the legislature overwhelmingly and the governor passed this bill. I think it's been shown that including medical operators is the best way to move forward. And the one state that didn't do it is New York. New York didn't include its medical operators from the get-go. They delayed medical operators by a number of years. And what you're seeing now is, I'll call it the near death of the medical cannabis program in New York. And I don't think I need to, you know, tell your listeners how horrific the rollout of adult use cannabis has been in New York. So I think that was, frankly, the choice for legislators here, and they overwhelmingly made it, was, do we want to have a successful program that allows, you know, sales to get up and running and protects the medical businesses, allows for funding to go to social equity ones, or do we want to go the way of New York? And I think our policymakers in Delaware showed that very clearly, how, what they want.
Absolutely. And I think transitioning a little bit back to just the adult use recreational market in general, obviously Delaware has had some hiccups in getting its recreational market up and going, or at least it's been taking a while. Do you believe that this is unique to Delaware? Are there some specific challenges you think this state has been facing in this sphere, or do you see this kind of playing out as a normal introduction to the adult use market?
I think it's as clear as day. Policymakers realize that they should have passed this bill as part of legalization, that the path to be able to get, you know, to get adult use sales off the ground in part was including medical operators, and they've fixed that. You know, Delaware has had a very, very, very long rollout, and remind you that it's not that people in Delaware are not purchasing cannabis. They're purchasing it from unregulated sources, whether it's the traditional illicit market or it's now a robust, intoxicating, unregulated cannabis market that's being sold in gas stations. And so I think this is going to go a long way to making sure that the program gets up and running soon, because Delawareans have waited long enough. And I know that policymakers look to the public in this, and they don't see that long delays in this, the proliferation of an unregulated marketplace, is a good public policy outcome. And this bill goes to great lengths to correct that. And I think now Delaware, with the passage of this bill, is going to be able to have a successful rollout. But without it, I think Delaware was going the way of New York.
And that's a really great segue, really, into just talking about the timeline as well. You know, we know that the applications for conversion licenses will open up on August 1st, and then none can be issued after November 1st. Do you see, similarly, that the marijuana commissioner, he believes that the market's going to be up and running by early 2025. Do you think that we are on track to meet that target with all of these deadlines?
I do. I think the regulator deserves a lot of kudos for approaching this pragmatically, to be able to take a program that has, you know, not gotten off the ground and to jumpstart it. And we're happy to play a role in that. We are hopeful and optimistic that by 2025, early in 2025, that Delawareans 21 and up will be able to go into a regulated market, regulated dispensary, and be able to purchase taxed and trusted cannabis products. Because right now, their alternative is to purchase unregulated products being sold in gas stations.
And I mean, after everything is said and done, what would you say a successful dual market should look like? And how will Delaware know if or when it has achieved that status?
Well, one would be, you know, something that we've shown a strong track record in every one of the other states that we operate in, that, you know, we'll continue to sell, you know, and service medical patients to the degree that we have, and better. The rollout of adult use is going to create a larger market size, which is going to mean greater availability and selection for medical patients, likely for lower prices as more and more economies of scale come in here. So I think that's going to be apparent on day one of adult use sales, when a medical patient continues to get priority access in our dispensaries. And then the other measure of success is when the tax revenue is rolling into the state, when unregulated dispensaries at a gas stations are no longer in operation. And most importantly, when Delawareans 21 and up can go into an adult use dispensary and responsibly consume regulated product. That's the promise of legalization. And I think Delaware, with the quicker onset to sales that this bill allows for, is on the right track for.
Thanks to Adam Gores, Senior Vice President of Corporate Affairs for The Cannabis Company, and our Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We explore the threat posed by the invasive and highly destructive box tree moth, which was recently found in a Kent County home. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service reported the discovery of a box tree moth recently in a Kent County home. The box tree moth, typically found in New York, Michigan, and Massachusetts, is an unexpected find here in Delaware. They're federally regulated bugs that mostly feed on boxwood shrubs, and if left unchecked, can quickly destroy and potentially kill plants. Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry caught up with Brian Kunkel, Cooperative Extension Specialist of Ornamentals Integrated Pest Management at the University of Delaware, to learn more about the box tree moth and how to prevent this invasive pest from spreading throughout the state.
When we say an insect is invasive, can you define that for us and what it exactly means to be an invasive species?
Most people refer to invasive species as being species that are not native to the area and that are able to come in, establish a population and reproduce successfully and spread throughout that area, and often will damage potential host plants or outcompete native fauna or animals that are there and make life difficult for them to be able to persist. So that eventually it becomes more and more commonly seen and more destructive in its behavior and what it does. And so in the case of the box tree moth, when you first get that first population come in and the females lay their eggs, they feed a little bit on the boxwood, and then that first generation completes itself probably before any natural enemies are able to recognize it as a suitable host or something that they can eat. And then they have each one of those gets to find a partner potentially, and then increase the population even more. And then so as that occurs, until natural enemies or human intervention, their populations can start to cause quite a bit of damage. And often invasive insects are the result of human shipping of things. We'll accidentally, for example, for like the spotted lanternfly, it came over accidentally on food or on packing or crates or whatever, and we didn't know it was here. And then, oh, the next year, there it was. And so the box tree moth hadn't been in Delaware. And the only way that I'm aware that it would have been able to get here, because it's not that great a flyer. I mean, it's strong, but not hundreds of miles strong in its flight capability, would be to have human-assisted movement into a new location.
Well, you don't necessarily have to speak to specifics with the box tree and how it was specifically found, but do you have an idea of how that process normally works with an invasive insect as reported and how the state manages invasive insect cases?
My understanding is that the USDA and the Department of Agriculture work close hand in hand and are made aware of arthropods of concern, meaning those that are potentially invasive for our area that have been discovered in states or other locations on the continent that could be problematic for our state or our region. And then they have professionals that keep their eye open for those occurrences as they go about their daily activities, depending on what those are. I mean, if you're a nursery inspector, as you look at nursery crops, you're going to inspect the crop in question for an ornamental pest like the box. You're going to look for those to see if you see them come in so it doesn't get into the landscape. The downside is there's always not enough people to get all the work done. Plus, there's so many plants that you can't inspect every single plant. That would be a near impossibility to look at every single plant in every single nursery all year long. I mean, it's a numbers game, and we focus activities are focused upon the life cycles of those invasives, and everybody does the best that they can or what's expected of them. I mean, they do as good a job as anybody else would, obviously. Otherwise, if we were perfect, we wouldn't be having this discussion. And so with the way trade has gone and expanded, with it occurring much more worldwide all over the place, not in specific ports, although it occurs with greater frequency in some of the larger ports, it makes it easier or facilitates the ability of some animals and even plants that are not from our area to sneak in unobserved, and then they get a foothold, and then it can become a challenge for those said agencies working with other professionals to try and eradicate them when possible. Unfortunately, that's often quite difficult and impossible once it's already here and by the time we find it. And if you think about like the emerald ash borer, for example, it snuck in by the time we saw it and noticed it causing significant damage in Michigan near Detroit. It had already been here. We just don't know how many years because we didn't know when it first got here. And it had built up a population that essentially made eradication near impossible. Hopefully, I mean, we do the best we can to keep the expansion down. Unfortunately, some of those arthropods or plants or diseases are able to get a foothold that's strong enough that we can't get rid of.
So what other invasive insects might we see this time of year in Delaware? And what should we keep an eye out for?
So if you have crepe myrtles, there is the crepe myrtle bark scale. The University of Maryland and University of Delaware have been working on it in the Mid-Atlantic, trying to get an idea of when their populations fluctuate. And we're about to start the second generation, we think. There's been tons of work that's been done by scientists in the Southeast and in the Gulf Coast states that got a good base work of how it acts in the United States and what feeds on it and management options. But nobody has really done a lot of that in the Mid-Atlantic. And so some of that requires knowledge of their phenology or when the crawlers, for example, are at their peaks or out and about moving on the plant so that we can better time and target or control operations. And so we're trying to determine what some of that is. Spotted lanternfly adults, the Department of Ag in Delaware and the USDA do a great job of coordinating, communicating their observations and their efforts in trying to watch and manage and reduce the movement of spotted lanternflies. They do an excellent job with that. And they informed us a couple weeks ago that the first adults for spotted lanternfly are out up and down the state. And so that could be an invasive insect that we would see. Emerald ash borer is flying, it's an exotic invasive. I would imagine that their adult activity is probably starting to wane. They usually start activity, I think, around the end of May, and then big flights or a lot of activity in June, and then, of course, goes after ash trees. So the box tree moth, obviously, has been found here. Its exact timing for its activity, I'm not 100% certain when those generations. I've read that we may have two, possibly three here, but two seems like a more certain, but I'm not sure exactly when those time periods are. I know that we just recently, we had a couple in captivity. They were double bagged so that they couldn't escape. We had cocoons and they just emerged. So I would imagine that out in the landscape near that site where they initially were found, if they had not been treated, that we could be having adults flying potentially. I can't say for certain because control efforts were done. If I had to guess, if there were some that avoided management, then we could be having adults flying again. And how long before we'd have caterpillars feeding, I'm not sure, but I would imagine it'd be a week or two. You could start seeing caterpillars again. But those are the biggest invasives that I can think of off the top of my head that are a concern.
And some invasive insects are worse than others, right? Or are they just all disruptive and destructive in their own way?
So some of it depends. So, for example, emerald ash borer is quite destructive on ash trees. But ash trees are a smaller component of our forests than they are, say, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, or Michigan. When we have ashes, a lot of times it's around homes or homeowner association subdivisions and whatnot. We can have a few more ash trees in those locations, so the impact may be greater seen there. But in terms of the overall like forest community, the impact would be less compared to, say, what we had with Dutch elm disease or whatnot in the past. Spotted lanternfly for ornamentals or meaning like trees and shrubs around people's yard. The spotted lantern fly is really nothing more than a nuisance in that it does not cause mortality of trees. It may stress some trees, and if the infestation's high enough, it could potentially stress a tree to the point where multiple years of that, it could be susceptible to something else. That doesn't mean it's not a threat for grapes and hops. So any vineyard that has spotted lantern fly, they should be concerned. In regards to corn, soybean, watermelon, and peppers, three big agricultural crops in Delaware, it really doesn't have that much of an impact. Whereas brown marmorated stink bug, when it came, when it was really high in populations around 2010, 2012, that time frame, it had a bigger impact on our traditional ag production, soybean, corn. It was a bigger pest. Crepe myrtle bark scale, it reduces the flowering of crepe myrtles, and it'll take a really pretty barked tree and cover it in honeydew, which gets colonized by sooty mold, and it's kind of gray and dingy and dirty looking. So it'll take a really pretty tree and make it look unkempt and unhealthy when the tree itself is mostly okay. It's just not able to produce as many flowers, and it doesn't look as nice. And so for each invasive pest, the impact it has in terms of economic impacts or wildlife impacts, it can vary from spot to spot.
So let's say we find an invasive insect like the box tree moth. What should we do? Kill it and report it? What's the best course of action?
The best course of action I'm aware of is to inform the Department of Agriculture. And if you don't know what the Department of Agriculture's number is, or you can't get a hold of them, you could reach out to Cooperative Extension in any of the offices and let them know. And then we would inform the Department of Ag.
Thanks to UD's Brian Kunkel, Cooperative Extension Specialist in Ornamentals Integrated Pest Management, and our Joey Irizarry for taking time to join us on The Green this week. And The Green continues next with Arts Playlist, where we preview a new exhibition that explores the meaning of truth at the Biggs Museum of American Art. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The question, what is truth, is no longer simply a philosophical debate. It's an increasingly daily ask in a polarized society that consistently grapples with questions about the nature of truth. In that spirit, the Biggs Museum of American Art is rolling out a new exhibition, Circle of Truth, 49 paintings ending with Ed Ruscha, which unpacks the concept of truth and how our perceptions, biases, and interpretations shape our understanding of reality. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon is joined by Biggs curator Laura Fravell to explore Circle of Truth.
All right, Laura, there's a lot to sort through here with Circle of Truth. It's a collaborative project featuring 49 contemporary artists. It took 9 years to complete, and I think that's a great place, and what I think is a really interesting place for us to start is, you know, that process, the entire process of developing the exhibit, which I read is likened to a childhood game known to most as telephone. So can you walk us through what that process looked like and the meaning behind the method?
Yeah, so I think it's a pretty simple idea to understand because so many people played this game as a child. I knew it as telephone. I've met other people who knew it as rumor. But the idea of starting a conversation by whispering in somebody's ear, they whisper into the next person's ear, they whisper into the next person. And this, people mishear things, they misinterpret things. So by the time you get to the end of the chain, whatever the starting topic sentence was has completely changed and morphed. And usually people burst out laughing that it's gotten so ridiculous. And this is kind of the artist version of that, where the first artist in the series mailed their work to the next one with a blank canvas in the same crate, same size. That artist then, in this little crate designed for two pieces, would mail their piece and a blank canvas to the next artist. So nobody knew who came before them in the series. They were just given this prompt of what is the truth you see in this canvas? You had to respond to the one before you, but also convey your own truth using the skills you have and then send that on the way. And I don't think the curators of the show, Shane Gufug and Laura Hipke, really realized how long this would take or how big it would get. That it was kind of a little insular project started at Farrer Market in LA back in 2007. That organization actually shuttered in 2009 for economic reasons. But the project kept going and endured, and life intervened. But some artists respond right away within a week. Sometimes things happen. Somebody has a death in the family and has this canvas for 3 months, 6 months, and takes a little while to get back to it. So morphed many times over the course of the project and ended in 2016. And that's another hurdle that I don't think the curators originally foresaw, that the nature of truth changed so much in our political climate. And the show itself is not overtly political, but the way we talk about truth changed so much at that moment and is continuing to change today.
Yeah, I'd say as a concept, truth probably has never been more debated, or at least as a topic of discussion. But I'm also curious, Laura, as a longtime curator and as someone who has worked in the likes of, you know, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum in New York, the Smithsonian American Art Museum in D.C., Winterthur, you know, listeners, you get it. Laura's been around. But, you know, have you ever heard of something like this before, just in that process, that, you know, that rumor, that telephone-like or esque process in terms of development? Does anything similar come to mind on that?
I have not. And I think that's one of the things that attracted us to this show is so many exhibitions are organized by institutions, that they're often already existing work curators are selecting from things they know about. But to start a show not knowing where it will go or what people will respond along the way, and just let the work morph organically, that is a very brave thing to do, and to let this expand as it goes. It was, as I said, originally conceived for this particular venue, Farrer Market in LA. And every canvas in the show is 20 inches square, so they're relatively small. And that was intended to fit in that space way back in 2007. And they just calculated, okay, how much space do we have in this room? We can fit 49 canvases if we do this size, and plan the show with this very narrow vision in mind, but gave it the space to change over the years. So this show never really ended up in that venue and has been traveling since then. And I think that's one thing that attracted us too, that we saw a hole in our calendar. We saw that this was available. It's a little different for the bigs, that we are a collection pretty much focused on the Delaware River Valley, artists in this area. And to bring in what is a relatively simple and novel idea from a mostly West Coast group of artists to share with our own audience, I think that lets us bridge that divide across the country too, in some ways.
Yeah, I love that. Something very, you know, at least from an outsider's perspective here, you know, something very human and organic, and there's so much character to this. Just a lot to be excited about. You know, but as far as the artist behind this, Laura, you know, among the 49, you know, contemporary artists that make up this exhibit, you know, I'm sure it's tough to choose from, but are there any that stand out to you specifically?
Yes and no. And I say 49, it's actually going to be 50 artists, because it's intended as a series of 49. And then the 50th responder is you, the viewer, that you are the final arbiter on truth and how you take in the whole series, you respond to the final work, what you come away with. So it's a little interactive of putting you in that final place. And it's hard to pick out a single favorite, just because what makes it special is these are necessarily in conversation with each other. And so I think of kind of favorite runs in the show, of you'll have 4 to 6 in a row that clearly are responding to each other more closely. And then it'll jump, where one artist zigs where everybody else zagged, and become a very different animal. One of my favorite moments is earlier in the show, in the first series of, there's a painting based on the golden ratio, kind of this architecture that's in nature, in flowers, in facial structures, proportions. But the artist was afraid that would be too obvious and camouflaged it. So there's kind of these warm colors. There's this veil painted over the front that they didn't want to be too apparent and too much like it was coming out of a science textbook. And the next artist completely did not see the golden ratio at all. They just saw the warm colors and then made their own painting winter themed as kind of continuing the seasons. And then the artist after that didn't even see the winter. They just saw these very geometric stripes and painted their own rendition of a cat's face with stripes over it, kind of claw marks coming down. You never know when you put something out there in the series what the next artist will see in your work or how they're going to respond to it. And you have no control over that.
As far as the theme goes, then, I mean, for you speaking anecdotally, you know, we're looking at, you know, the human psyche here and this concept of truth and this need for, you know, meaningful, authentic, like truthful interactions almost. And also, you know, all these other themes around truth where, you know, how our surroundings and our nature affect that and our reality of truth. How do you feel anecdotally that is communicated through this exhibit and the artwork?
And truth, I will say, is such a loaded word and can mean so many things. And the idea of a show of what is truth just sounds so broad. But I think within the show, within 49 different perceptions of what is truth, it opens it up to a lot of different approaches and different facets to that. That some artists see truth and think, we go back to my scientific textbooks and diagrams and try to come up with this underlying structure and architecture for the universe, forms that look like they're under a microscope. Some people turn to art history and trompe l'oeil painting, trying to fool the eye, trying to force you to decipher what is real versus what is painted by their hand, what's a collage bit versus what has carefully added shadows to make it look fake. And then there's that personal element too, of maybe truth is my lived experience, my biography, how I bring what I know to this image I'm looking at. And that informs that truth. So it is a very broad term to try to encapsulate in the show. And I'm curious what our audience is going to see when they respond to it as well.
Given that background we've kind of laid out, how has that affected the installation process? I feel like it'd be more challenging, you know, for XYZ reason, you know, putting everything together. But I'm neither a curator nor an artist. So, you know, but how has that specificity that Circle of Truth presents played out in the installation?
The installation process, I will say, was interesting. But in some ways, this sounds like it would be straightforward, that it's 49 canvases, all the same size, all the same hanging hardware, and numbered. So they're in a particular order. But I know we had a lot of internal conversations about how people will move through this show of our museum is a series of smaller spaces. Do we have everybody walk around the entire space looking at just one wall and then loop back and do the other side of the room? Within each room, is it a smaller circle as you walk around and do little laps and repeat those circles and patterns over and over? Do we have to diagram the space for people, or can we trust them to find the next number and read these in order? And I say read because it's not just the canvas, but every artist wrote a small statement of what they saw in the previous piece and how they sought to address it. And as you follow this along, it's almost like continuing the next chapter in the story. And it's fascinating to see the leaps of things that to one person were so obvious and apparent, and to the next person did not see them at all, just completely missed whatever the intention was of the previous painting.
Once again, this seems very human and very engaging. But what's the timeline look like for this exhibit, Laura?
So this exhibit is going to be with us till pretty much the end of September. And we have some interesting programs alongside the show, too. We have both of the curators coming to do a virtual program if you want to join us from wherever you are and ask them questions directly. We're also partnering with Delaware Humanities. So we have some of their speakers coming, and we have a talk in August called The Right to Lie, thinking about how in our culture historically, politicians have kind of bended the truth, and public speakers have bended the truth to share their points more convincingly or to tap into things that people sort of knew from lived experiences but hadn't actually found a voice for.
Thanks to Biggs Museum of American Art curator Laura Fravel and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we meet a Smyrna couple working to create an ossuary to give skeletons donated to science a proper final home. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Human bodies donated to science are used in various ways for research, education, and medical testing. Most remains will be cremated after they've been used and either scattered or returned to their next of kin. But some end up shoved away, abandoned by institutions, and forgotten. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Rachel Sawicki visits one Smyrna couple's home to learn how they are rescuing skeletons and giving life back to the dead.
Everyone who steps foot through Justin Capps and Sonia Cobb's front door is greeted by Meredith.
Meredith is the strange one here. As you can see, I'm 6 foot six, and Meredith's skeleton's almost as tall as I am. That's one of those things that's kind of indicative of a male, but from the pelvic region, that is female. But some of the other features and stuff all scream male. The prominent brows and stuff like that. This is one that I would really like to get DNA tested just to make sure, because I may have an anomaly of sorts here. I don't know.
Yes, you heard that right. Meredith is a skeleton, and a real one. Past the hallway and to the right sit Morticia and Gomez.
Now, this is a female and a male skeleton, and I like them together in this one case, even though they have a divider, because this gives me an opportunity to show people how to tell the difference between a male and a female.
And further into the living room, underneath the television.
This one here in the big black light lit case, this is Eve. Now, we call her Eve because she's the oldest of all the skeletons we have. We figure her to be sometime late 1700s, early 1800s.
Justin and Sonia have a total of 7 complete skeletons, as well as 3 skulls, various bones, a spine lamp, and tons of taxidermy. But they're not collectors, Justin insists.
They're privately held, privately maintained, and discreetly kept. We do not do that. We are 100% public. We're federally recognized. We can be verified through the IRS, and we gather these things together so they continue to be used in the public eye.
It all started with the idea to start a medical museum. Sonia has a medical license and worked in hospice many years ago, and through her connections with other practitioners, they came across several old medical instruments and tools that Justin calls one of a kind. But they met Tyler in 2018 at one particular oddity store they frequented. Tyler is a geriatric human skull with just one tooth.
And of course, because it's a geriatric skull and Sonia working in hospice, she fell in love with it.
Tyler wasn't for sale, but Sonia and Justin talked about him a lot. In 2020, the shop owner, who the pair became friends with over the years, was forced to close during the pandemic, and the couple wanted to help out.
But due to the sum of money that it was, we would ask that we could hold Tyler in the medical collection that we were establishing. And as soon as he had my money, he could come pick Tyler up and give me my money back. And if he never did, that was okay too, because it was very important to us that Tyler not sit in a storefront. He needed to be in a collection of some sort, a museum, something. Being sitting in the store, just it was our opportunity. So we took it and we rescued him.
That sparked an interest in acquiring other human medical specimens, but the cost of a complete skeleton ranges anywhere from $7,000 to $15,000, and it wasn't just the price that put the couple off.
When people gave themselves for the advancement of science and education, it was never meant to be butchered up and then pieced out for money here and there. It was so people like you and I could learn from them. And unfortunately, like everything else, it becomes big business, private business that nobody wants to talk about.
Justin and Sonia were further disturbed by where these specimens were listed for sale, including places like Facebook Marketplace.
So we're like, you know what? I have a very unique opportunity to do something nobody's ever seen before. Some people rescue puppies and kittens. Let's begin rescuing medical specimens.
Ultimately, their mission produced the Ossuary, now a 501c3 nonprofit. Anyone in the community can schedule a free visit to their home in Smyrna to see the specimens and learn more. Justin says he has access to about 1,200 skeletons through fraternal organizations in the U.S., but Sonia says there are probably tens of thousands in circulation worldwide. Most commonly, real human skeletons were found in museums or doctor's offices and other teaching facilities, but most have been replaced with newer, cheaper plastic replicas.
To find out that there are so many skeletons out there that were once used this way, and now what's become of them isn't fair, because that's not what they were meant to happen to them. It's not. I mean, I get that they were once used in a doctor's office and they hung there for people to see and to understand, but to be sold to somebody to just, it's not right.
Justin says there are various ways they acquire their specimens. Mostly they solicit reputable, established businesses or organizations that are willing to donate.
There are some instances I've had to put money out for shipping and insurance and stuff for the donations, but I've never actually physically bought any of them because we do not believe in buying previous people. I mean, to us, that's disgusting.
You can legally buy body parts in just about every state in America. However, Justin says they don't do business in three states, Louisiana, Tennessee, or Georgia, out of caution of the state's strict laws around transporting human remains. But by and large, human remains are considered products.
No more than the shoes on your feet.
After that person or a next of kin signs the consent forms to donate the body to science. Other ossuary missions include rescuing unclaimed cremated remains, or cremains. Some are unclaimed because they had no family or were wards of the state. Others are unclaimed because their family couldn't afford to recover them. In that case, the ossuary will try to reconnect the family with their loved one's cremains at no cost. The handling of unclaimed cremains was another factor in the ossuary's creation.
Every funeral home, they all legally, they have to hold them for so many years. And then after so many years, what do you do with them? I mean, funeral homes have shut down to the point that they've gone out of business, and the buildings have sold with cremains still in the building.
Before they started keeping the bones they acquired, the pair would bury remains and scatter ashes on Justin's family farm in Arkansas's Ozark Mountains, a generational cemetery where his family has been buried for more than 150 years. Justin says if he had the space, they could take in thousands of skeletons. But due to that limitation, they try to reserve their efforts for the most urgent cases until they can expand. Sonia explains their ultimate goal is to build America's first real ossuary.
Our ideal situation, we would love one day to have a church and to create a true ossuary in the United States where we could line the inside of the church with bones, have a chandelier made out of bones. Would be amazing. I've been to one in Germany when I lived in Germany, and it was amazing to see. And there isn't any here in the United States, and we would love to be able to do that.
In the United States, ossuaries refer to a secondary burial site containing the remains of multiple individuals. One of the most notable is the Indian Neck Ossuary on Cape Cod, accidentally discovered during backhoe digging on a project in 1979. It produced the remains of at least 56 individuals buried more than 1,000 years ago. But elsewhere in the world, ossuaries were founded to house skeletal remains when cemeteries were overcrowded and burial space scarce. Throughout ancient and medieval times in the Catholic and other Orthodox faiths, displaying and maintaining the bones of the deceased was a way to honor the dead. Some of the largest ossuaries include the Sedlec and Brno ossuaries in the Czech Republic, which each hold the remains of tens of thousands of people. The Paris catacombs are home to millions. Most ossuaries overseas contain the bones of former monks or parishioners and are now historical landmarks.
So I have no way of acquiring a bunch of human beings so that I can create a church. However, if the medical specimens are technically considered an item,
like property,
so those I can use them to create an ossuary, and there's not any laws around it.
Justin isn't sure if their goal is attainable in Smyrna, but perhaps in surrounding states.
In my dream, I would have some big stone gothic-y church like you would see in Philadelphia or something, but I would take any church that, you know, worked with me, and I would like to put these bones inside of the church and do the same thing where I could continue to perform weddings and funerals and allow an open door instead of by appointment.
For now, Justin and Sonia say they will continue to spread their message and educate those who will listen.
We do travel. Every once in a while, we'll take a skull because it's easy to travel with skull. Then we have taken the skeleton out before, too, for a day trip. And we go out and have lunch with them and just to raise awareness in public.
Negative reactions are few and far between, Justin and Sonia say, and the couple are confident in their mission and their values.
We give life back to death. We try to remember that these specimens were real people at one time. These were brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. Just as we are today, they once were. And what they are now, one day we will be.
Rachel Sawicki, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Rachel, for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible. Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry, Sarah Petrowich, and Rachel Sawicki, along with Delaware Public Media's senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.